rescue the perishing, care for the dying, snatch them in pity from sin and the grave, weep o'er the erring one, lift up the fallen, tell them of Jesus, the mighty to save. Those words were the basis of our study this morning, and as we concluded our lesson, I told you that this evening we'd be opening our Bibles to Luke chapter 15 and studying what I've called the rescue chapter. If we have our marching orders in the Great Commission, if our marching orders tell us to rescue the perishing, to seek the lost, as that other song we sang suggests, then there are some things recorded here in Luke chapter 15 that tell us how and show us the way. You know the parables very well that are recorded there. Three parables in Luke chapter 15. You'll recall that one of them was about a lost sheep and the shepherd who left the 99 and went out into the wilderness to find that one that had become lost. The next parable in that chapter was about that lost coin that the woman, as we would say today, turned her house upside down trying to find. And then the most well-known parable in Luke chapter 15 is the one about the boy, the son. We call him the prodigal son. The son who evidently grew up in a fine family, but who upon reaching a certain age told his father he was ready to get whatever was his of the family. He wanted to go out on his own. And you remember he did. He went out on his own. He went into the far country of sin and wasted his substance and riotous living and eventually found himself in the hog pen eating the food that was given to the pigs. And he came to himself, the Bible says, and he concluded that he'd be far better off if he could just be a servant in his father's house rather than staying in this deplorable situation that he had actually created for himself. The parable tells of the young man going back home and his grand reception by his father, the bad attitude of his older brother. We won't read this chapter, but those are three summaries of what we find there. Let's study this chapter as the rescue chapter, and let's open up the toolkit, the rescue toolkit, the things, just a few of the things, a few of the many things that could be used in the task to rescue the perishing. I'm going to give you some bare bones tonight in the PowerPoint. It's not the kind that I normally do. I don't like for you to get tired of the same old thing, and so this is going to be just the basic outline as we consider some of these tools. As we think about these tools, I want you to look with me to the opening words of this chapter. Actually, before Jesus got to the parable, it says in verse 1, "Now all the tax collectors and the sinners were coming near him to listen to him." Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Now, if you couldn't tell from the tone of the words, that's a negative thing. They were leveling a charge against Jesus. They were saying he doesn't have any credibility because he's allowing the sinners to come and eat with him. He receives sinners and eats with them. Why were the tax collectors and sinners drawing near to Jesus? The Lord wasn't giving out door prizes. He wasn't offering a reward to anybody who would come and be counted in the multitude around him. In fact, on one occasion, Jesus spoke some very strong words and told the people that had come to hear him, "You need to check and make sure you're willing to follow through with what I'm telling you to do. Otherwise, you need to go away." We know that there were some who did follow the Lord in order to get a free meal in John chapter 6, but they were the exception rather than the rule. Maybe it was because Jesus was teaching them the kind of things that people really like to hear. Maybe he was an ear tickler, do you suppose? I hardly think so. No, Jesus wasn't peddling a soft message. It wasn't that that caused those people to come and follow him and listen to him. It wasn't that he compromised on sin and was softer in his teaching than the contemporary religious leaders. No. But I think maybe our understanding of this situation becomes even more clear when we understand the full meaning of the word that the scribe, or that the Pharisees and the scribes used. They said, "Jesus receives sinners and eats with them." Now you need to know that there are several words in the Greek text that are all translated into the one word English, receives. In fact, I could take you to three or four different verses just really quickly where the English translation reads receives, but the Greek uses a different word for each of them. The word that is used here in this particular verse, verse 2 of Luke 15, is a very specific term for receive, and it means to treat kindly and offer hospitality. He's nice to these people. You don't want to follow Jesus. He's being nice to the sinners. More than 9 specific times we find the inspired writers recording the fact that Jesus had compassion on those around him. He felt compassion. He had compassion. He was compassionate. Yes, he was receiving sinners. He was compassionate. There's our first tool, compassion. We'll never make any headway in the matter of reaching the lost or rescuing the perishing if we don't have compassion. I suppose I've illustrated it like this before, but when you're driving down the road and you come upon an accident scene, a lot of times you'll see people gathering around where something has happened. And generally, there are 3 kinds of people there. Number 1, there are the gawkers, the people who are just curiosity seekers who have seen that something's happened and they want to know what happened and how it happened and who did it and is it anybody I know and things like that. Secondly, you've got the law enforcement guys who are there strictly to try to keep traffic moving and prevent any further accidents from happening. They really don't have time to try to sort out who this is and all of those kind of things, because the first priority belongs to the 3rd class of people, the paramedics. Those who have the medical training, who are there to try to render assistance to those who've been injured. The gawkers don't care who's hurt or how bad they're hurt, generally speaking. The cops don't have time. It's not their job to see to those who are injured. They've got a more important job to do in controlling the traffic. It's the paramedics, whose job illustrates the compassion we need to have for lost souls. And so when it comes to reaching the lost, let me ask all of us this question. Which one of those three categories do you find yourself in? Are you just somebody who's a curiosity seeker? Are you somebody who's worried about everybody else following the rules? Are you the person who has compassion for a lost soul? In Colossians chapter 3, verse 12, Paul says, "Put on then as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience." I think when you consider all of those things that Paul gives in that little short, non-conclusive list, you'll find that every single one of them is valuable in the task of reaching the lost. Here's another tool. This one's a given. Effort. We see an illustration of this tool there in verses 3 and 4 of the parable, where Jesus says that what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he's lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 98, 99. I've lost one. Well, it's cold out there. I'll wait till in the morning. Get on a dry pair of socks. I'll go out there and find that lost sheep when the sun comes up. No, no. Jesus says, you'll leave the 99 and you'll go out then, immediately, in the dark, in the danger. You'll make every effort you can to find that one that's lost and bring him back. You know, he decided, or he showed the decision to put active effort into the matter. I think a lot of folks in the Lord's church today look at the lost kind of like, well, you remember that movie? It starred Kevin Costner and can't remember the other guy's name, but remember the tagline, "If you build it, they will come." Field of Dreams. It was all about plowing up a cornfield and making a baseball field. And if he would make that baseball field, all of these old heroes, the ghost of them anyway, would come back and play on that ball field. If you build it, they will come. You might call that the 7-Eleven approach. I remember for years the 7-Eleven convenience stores would buy a lot two blocks from the present store, or maybe even across the street, and they'd build a brand spanking new one and they'd close that other one right there across the street, and people would just flock to that new store. Winn-Dixie did that for a time, but that marketing strategy finally stopped working. But there are a lot of folks, I think, who look at reaching the lost in that very way. Let's build a nice big church building. Let's make sure everything is really pretty around here, and they'll come. You know what? There are some who will come, but all of them won't. In fact, most of them won't, if all we do is build a nice, comfortable church building. You know, there's got to be active effort to reach the lost. There's a lot of activity that goes on around here in that regard. Vacation Bible school every summer. Gospel meetings. Friends and family day. Got one coming up Sunday after next. Don't forget that. House to House magazine that goes out to all of the houses in our particular area. The Mexico mission work, our support for mission efforts in South Dakota and Panama and other places. There's a lot going on. I wonder how many of us who proudly lay hold to this as our congregation and look what we're doing, how faithful are we in really putting an effort into supporting those things? We need to give an emphasis to individual effort. The corporate effort is very important, but we need to be individually interested and making efforts to rescue the perishing away from this church building. Every day of the week, at school, at the ball field, at work, wherever we find ourselves, there'll be opportunities to reach the lost, to rescue the perishing. The third tool is illustrated there in verse 8, where Jesus says, "Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it?" It's not easy to reach the hearts of people who are lost. In fact, usually first efforts only rarely meet with success. It takes repeated efforts that are fed by a determination and a willingness to stick with the effort, to stay the course, to accomplish the goal, to find the coin, to rescue the perishing. That determination has to be balanced with wisdom. Sometimes it's challenging to know when to quit and move on to somebody else. In some cases, particularly with family members and close friends, it may take years of persistent efforts and steadfast work. Some of the most effective teaching that we can do to those around us is godly living. I remember the case of two families, and I think I've told you about this, two families who worshiped with us where my dad preached when I was a teenager. The husbands of those two families were very good friends and close neighbors. They were good men in the community. But neither of those men was a Christian. Though their families were some of the most faithful in the congregation, and those men even attended with their wives and children at every service. If you ever tried to take one of them aside and talk to him about obeying the gospel, he'd very quickly tell you, "I understand, I appreciate your point, just not ready, just not ready." After more than 20 years of persistent efforts to reach them, accompanied by the godly example of their wives, one Sunday morning, without any kind of warning to anybody, both of those men stepped out into the aisle and came forward during the invitation song, obeying the gospel, and were baptized into Christ. It was the happiest day that that church had seen in a long, long time, as you might imagine. It had taken years of determined work, but nobody had given up on them. One aspect of our work to reach the lost, to rescue the perishing, is a determination that does not easily give up. I realize there's another parable there. We'll get to that in just a minute, in a little different way. Let's think about some common denominators. some things all of these parables have in common. All of these parables, you don't need me to tell you this, are about the same basic situation. Lostness. Now I realize, and Microsoft tells me that's not really a word. They've got a red line under it here on my screen. But you know what I mean. You know what I'm trying to convey when I say lostness. All three of these parables are about bringing back that which had been lost. All of them were lost, but each of them was lost in a different place. The sheep was lost out there in the wilderness. The implication from the parable seems to be that the shepherd had to go back out to a dangerous place under dangerous conditions at night to search for that lost sheep. And he did. And he found it. The coin was lost in the house. It was lost inside. There's a lot of local lostness around here. Don't think for a second that it cannot happen right here at home. Maybe there's someone, even among us, who is drifting incrementally, and all of a sudden we look around and we say, "Where's so and so?" Yes, you can be lost even from within a congregation just like this. Maybe we need to light some more lamps and move some furniture around and make sure that we're finding everybody who's leaning toward lost. In that third parable, the one about the lost son, he was lost because he thought there was something better than his father's house. He left and went away to what we describe as the far country of sin. And there he engaged in riotous living, wasting everything that he had, so that at the end of the story, he was in danger of starving. He came back. But why did he come back to his father's house? He came back to his father's house because he knew it was a place of love and compassion. And a part of our job in seeking the lost, and especially those who may have wandered away and gone off even into the far country of sin, part of our responsibility is making sure that they understand and that we demonstrate that this is a place of love and acceptance and warmth and understanding and health for those who will come back. He didn't say, "I'll never go back to my father's house." No, that was where he went because he knew what it was. What do they know about us here at Redland Road? There's another thing, a common denominator, and that was the labor involved. In all three of these cases, the shepherd had to go look for the sheep. The woman had to light some lights and move some furniture. And and search for the coin. And even in the story of the son, there was the work and the function of that family that kept it the kind of place that he would come back to. The lost are not going to be saved if we don't put forth effort. It's not going to happen. God will not cause it to happen if we're not willing to put the labor into it. And then finally, the common denominator is the rejoicing. There was earthly rejoicing in all three of these cases. The shepherd rejoiced, invited his friends to rejoice with him. The woman rejoiced when she found the coin. Even the family of the son rejoiced and had a great celebration. The older brother was against it, but the logic of the father was clear. This is an occasion for happiness and rejoicing. Brothers and sisters, there should not be an occasion that would bring us any more joy than when a lost one comes to the Lord. In fact, John mentions this in 3 John verse 4. He says, "For I was very glad when the brethren came and testified to your truth." That is, how you are walking in truth. "I have no greater joy than this, than to hear of my children walking in the truth." That's what John said. But not just earthly rejoicing. There was heavenly rejoicing as well. In fact, verses 7 and 10 in Luke 15 express it this way. In the same way, Jesus says, "I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." Larry Bryant, contemporary gospel songwriter. And as the story goes, a few years ago, he heard a sermon on the angels in heaven rejoicing. And he wrote a song. It's a fun little song. It's not really a worshipful song, but it's got a really great message in it. Several popular contemporary groups have recorded this song. And here's some of the words. "At the completion of the golden gate, no, the angels did not celebrate. And when the right boys flew their bird, no angelic shouts were heard. There's only one thing that we're sure about that can make those angels jump and shout. It's when a sinner makes the Lord his choice. That's when the angels rejoice." Now, when the light bulb first lit up the town, no, the angels did not dance around. And when the man stepped on the moon, they didn't sing a victory tune. There's only one thing that we're sure about that can make those angels jump and shout. It's when a sinner makes the Lord his choice. That's when the angels rejoice. An important point. As Jesus said, there is joy among the angels in heaven when one is brought to the Lord. What kind of job are we doing at rescuing the perishing, seeking the lost? Passages like this chapter, give us the guidelines. Let's put it to use. If you're subject to our Lord's invitation in any way, we invite you to respond as we stand together and sing this song.